next team to come and talk us upon impairment. Ooh, I didn't mean it. I'll come to them.
Okay. This is agenda paper 2, and it was some slides that were handed out to you all. I'll just quickly go over what the model is today, or what we're proposing the model will be, what the board has tentatively decided on. And then what I would like to focus on are the disclosures that we've included within this package. And from a user perspective, which disclosures are very helpful, including in today's IFRS 7, what additional information you would need, and then also from a preparer perspective, what information that you provide today is quite costly to provide, and what information that we've included in here would definitely would you be able to provide?
Before you do that, go further, could you just tell us the timeline? Because a couple of people have asked me about timeline, where we stand on it.
Sure. We are in July planning to bring back, from the ISB perspective, all of the additional issues that we've identified so far, in order to complete the deliberations related to the new model. And then after that, provided that the board agrees that we can begin drafting and gives us permission to do that, then we'll start drafting, and we can issue an exposure draft in the fourth quarter of this year.
Thanks.
Okay. We presented to you before. I think it's clear why there's a project on impairment. As far as, you know, there was an issue with today's incurred loss model, which recognizes impairment losses when a trigger event has occurred and the impact can be reliably estimated. That then results in expected losses not being recognized before a trigger event. So the model, which is outlined on slide 4, generally speaking, all assets that are originated begin in bucket 1 or category 1. They get recognize a 12-month expected loss allowance. At some point, when there has been more than an insignificant deterioration in credit quality and it's at least reasonably possible that the cash flows may not be collected, the assets will transfer out of bucket 1 and then be recognized with a lifetime expected loss. There are some exceptions to the model related to purchase credit impaired assets, trade receivables, and lease receivables, which if you have questions on, I'd be happy to go over. What this model will do then, obviously, is bring up the recognition of losses so that you alleviate the too little too late problem. So with that, moving to slide 9, management will use judgment when determining when to transfer between the buckets, and also when estimating the expected credit losses. Beginning on slide 10 through 14 are the possible disclosure about impairments and what we are hoping to achieve with these disclosures. There are several tables that we've included in here of examples, and then below those tables were possible narrative and other disclosures. Instead of walking through each of those, I'd like to get to the questions because I know our time is running short. So from a user perspective, well, actually, I guess I should ask, does anybody want to ask me any questions first?
Yes, Martin.
I just had a question. We're not talking, are we talking both about loans and listed bonds where there are prices? Both, huh?
We're talking about everything that's measured at amortized cost.
Then I wonder,
or if fair value is real estate.
Suppose I see this bond hitting 60 and I bought it for 100. Can I lean back and say, well, this is not really a credit thing. This is pure liquidity.
Well, I think you'd have to. The price, well, you wouldn't be required to write it down to 60, but you'd have to take into account market information regarding what the market thinks the expected credit losses are. If that is, if you come to the judgment that that's because of liquidity,
it's liquidity. I'm pretty sure.
If that was the logic used in the Greek bonds, it did not fly.
Just pressing my luck here.
The point is, you can't really ignore observable information, but...
I agree. I see a lot of liquidity premium.
In Greek bonds, right? We're talking Greek bonds. Yeah. Liquidity premium. Yeah, I agree.
I see people seeing a lot of liquidity. It's just that, here, deterioration in credit quality. I mean, how do you point credit quality if you cannot be certain whether it's liquidity or credit quality? Or I'm just playing the bad guy now.
There's comments about that.
It's a good question, and I think it does come to the disclosures that we're going to talk about, because it does involve judgment. And as a user, you'll probably need some additional information about how an entity has applied that judgment, because I guess entities would be required to disclose fair values as well. Mm-hmm. And if they've got their carrying amount that's greater than their fair value for example, a listed security, that would be an area where I'm guessing you would be interested why there is that variance.
Or maybe we need a different criteria, not credit quality, but a significant deterioration in value.
I think the objective of the impairment model is for credit quality, and if it is due to liquidity, we wouldn't want to capture that in an impairment model that's focused on measuring credit expected losses due to credit risk.
Just a suggestion.
A scope question on slide 8, you refer to the application to trade and lease receivables. I just had a question which is closely related. For contract assets, for revenue recognition, has the board decided that those should not be covered in impairment?
For contract assets, well...
Contract assets.
This would... the impairment model would apply to the assets when they're kicked out of the revenue standard and into the FI standard. So I think under the revenue standard, it stays as a contract asset until there's no longer... the only thing left is the passage of time, I guess. There's no other conditions related to performance or anything. At that point, it gets kicked over to financial instruments, and then it falls under the... will fall under the requirements for impairment. Until that point, it's going to be under the revenue recognition standard.
And there are impairment provisions in the revenue proposals about contract assets.
Okay.
Neri.
Is there a day one loss for the 12 months bucket, or you park it somehow and recognize it through yield? And then it's my question, I have a second part. If there is, would there be then a different accounting for a loan that I originated and funded versus Gerard will originate and fund it, and I'll acquire it immediately after he funds it, and that way get a different answer? And then if that's the case and you have a day one loss, there's a day one loss for those 12?
There is a day one loss when there's
so
12 months.
The question that I have, given that, you know, yield and things are cyclical, what you're really likely to see, especially in volatile condition, that markets, people are going and fund a bunch of loans at particular points in the cycle when they think it's favorable. And then the market freezes, then they come back to the market. And then you get an asymmetric regard to day one loss. If you consider parking it on a balance sheet and recognizing it through a yield to reflect better some economic circumstances, but what I think going to happen is you're going to see a lot of people finding those loans, recognizing those day one loss in one extreme, and then telling all investors why they should ignore their income statement because it doesn't tell them anything, because it happened to be a period of really, really increase. You really have a booming business in day one loss. On the other hand, you're looking at other things, maybe they're simply going to swap loans. I'm going to put some things there, and then I'm going to purchase the loan and avoid the day one loss. So have you considered that this is going to be great? You're going to put it to market, and then a day later, you're going to go back to the drawing board because of all those issues.
Why would swapping loans will not have a day one?
Sorry?
If you purchased an asset that not at a deep discount due to incurred credit losses, yeah, it's going to get the same treatment. So you are going to recognize a 12-month expected loss on day one for that as well. If you purchase an asset with incurred credit loss at a deep discount with incurred credit losses, then you are going to include that expectation into the yield, into the effective interest rate calculation, and that will come
out. Actually, it becomes worse. If you buy from Gerard and have to put another 12 months extra, you have to bring it below your purchase price. It's assuming that Gerard sold you at a fair value, under this model, because of the 12 months, you will put an extra layer to the Gerard's sale price to you. So that's something which we recognize. Right, we recognize that as an issue, and I think, without being very political, that's a sort of a compromise we had to come to.
Have you thought about just recognizing those 12 months over some yield period rather than recognizing the day one loss? Because it's counterintuitive to me, the period of funding. If you have great underwriting and the business is really, really good, then in that quarter...
Mary, what you're describing is our original model.
Yes.
Okay. In the interest of trying to come to some compromise with our American colleagues, we ended up with this model that has just been described and the one that you have a problem with. But we recognize the flaws in it.
Yeah, the
it's going to be a short-term improvement in a couple of years.
In January when the SEC said no.
So, in the interest of actually being helpful for a change, we actually have to get to disclosures at some point, and so I'm going to phrase my question as a disclosure question. The answer is going to be disclosure. But what I was thinking about is this is great. So what I do is, because the company on page 9 is going to set the criteria. So when things are going well, I'm going to set my criteria tough, and I'm going to squirrel away some money in the level 2s. And then when things are going to go bad, I'm going to become more optimistic in my career criteria and move them back, because I can move them back. I'll move them back into 1. And so, which is a great way, and if I could do this well, I could probably really flatten out what really is doing this. So you asked column 3, if I had a blank sheet, what information would I like to add?
Criteria.
This is really a question of, you have to give us enough hard numbers on what the criteria is and what the portfolio is doing so that the management, the preparers, can't change the rules without telling us what you're doing. I actually, when we talk about volatility and some of these difficult estimates, I actually believe that the group that is best capable of giving us the right answer is actually the preparer. But the one thing I want, because they're closest to their numbers, the one thing, though, I want the preparers to not be able to do is change their assumptions. So if they honestly thought that the loan loss was 1%, I'll bet you that, and that's probably the right number. The only thing is, I don't want them to then next year quietly say, well, the loan loss is now going to be 1.2%, and I can't figure it out. And I think that discipline of you can put any assumption you want for these credit criteria, but if you change your mind, it's going to be quite obvious. And that means not only what you said, what the number is, but you need the dollar impact of what this change was. Then, all things being considered, this might work.
Martin.
Yeah. I have a bit of a biased background because I invested in bonds for some time, corporate bonds. And if I look at sheet 7, the fourth bullet, accrete the purchase price to the expected cash flows. Now, here's some demystification. We didn't really have such particular view on the true expected cash flows. We have a view on contractual cash flows. Do you really mean the expected cash flows, including, well, it may default next month, or in 2.5 years, or in 3.4 years, or, and then if it defaults in 3 months, we have recovery value of this, and in, because that's quite complicated, and PMs, analysts, if they have a portfolio of 120 bonds, may not have that view.
This is for just purchase credit impaired assets, so those that are purchased at a deep discount due to incurred credit losses. And this is the same model that is required today for those assets.
The short answer is yes. However, there could be practical expedients by which you would actually measure expected cash flows. So I'm familiar with the marketplace that you described, and I know that the way a PM will do that is not generally based on a discounted cash flow model, but based on prices. Because in this marketplace, the deep discount junk bond market basically moves on prices. So that's a proxy essentially for your expected cash flow, but that's the measurement objective, as opposed to the contractual cash flows. That is not the measurement objective.
Any other thoughts? You want to go through the questions, Sarah? How do you want to go do this?
Do the questions.
Okay.
For question one, what information provided today is useful in understanding the credit quality of an entity?
I think we heard one of them already from Robert. Right?
Any other thoughts on that question from the I know this is a user-specific question, but anything even preparers can chip in to say, what do you think? Just because you're a preparer, he doesn't mean you don't have view. Martin, go ahead.
I'm not a preparer. But
I know, but...
we've in the Netherlands, we've for the second year in a row requested companies... the question is... what would be useful to understanding credit quality of an entity? We request companies to disclose their bank covenants and the levels that they need to meet and how they perform on those levels. And about 95% now reports that information. We've actually decided that my employer, has decided that... it's probably wise for other countries and maybe for the world to have this type of disclosure. Mm-hmm. Bank covenants tend to be not disclosed, but they are important, and there's an asymmetrical information on this matter, and that is something that maybe may need to be alleviated.
Is the question is really credit quality of an entity, or is it an investment quality of an
entity? It's really to understanding the credit quality of the financial assets that the entity
underlying
has.
Credit quality.
Yeah.
It's kind of.
So it's not. I should reword that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I guess also the question that's not on here, is there anything in particular about the disclosures that were on those slides before that would be extremely useful and helpful? And in addition to that, is there anything that we missed that you need?
Well, I couldn't, and it's probably because I haven't sat down with a spreadsheet and tried to sort of reconcile all the numbers, but so I've got the carrying amount of the portfolio split between in bucket one and then buckets two and three. I can take the allowance that I've got in bucket one, add it to carrying value of bucket one, and get to the gross.
These are actually value. On the left hand side here. It's actually gross value.
Oh, these are gross values because that wasn't clear. Okay, because that says carrying amount, so it's the gross carrying amount. Okay, so then I could deduct that from there, and therefore what I can't see is the originations in bucket one. And transfers between buckets. I can see in the 12-month allowance what the provision was in bucket one, but I can't see what of that was relating to stuff that was originated in the current year that stayed in bucket one. So I can see the impact of the day one loss. I can't see.
Thank you, Jed. I couldn't agree with you more, and this is a disclosure which I feel very strongly that this model is going to have to require. However, we are hearing from the preparer community, the banking preparer community, that we can't get there from here. We can't do this. Okay. And in my mind, that defies logic, because what it says to me is you're not doing an inventory of your assets by these various categories, and you're not actually analyzing the movements from one period to another. So, you know, the original opposition to this model was it's going to require an awful lot of tracking. There is essentially an indirect amount of tracking that you'll have to do by essentially taking a snapshot at each balance sheet date of what you have and applying the model. you know, to it, the criteria for bucket one, bucket two, and in theory, in my mind, the difference between those snapshots are your transfers. Now, there's different ways, I think, of going about applying, you know, the model, depending on the sophistication of your systems, but I think this is going to be absolutely critical for the banking community to provide exactly what you said. People are going to want to know what moved from bucket one to bucket two or bucket two to bucket one, because we have criteria that call for that. So if you're applying those criteria, then it makes sense that you would actually disclose what the dollar amounts are, both the carrying value as well as the allowance.
Right. It should also be disclosed the movements between bucket two and bucket three. Because on bucket two, you have a collective provision, and in bucket three, you have specific provision loans by loans. I think it's very important to know the reality of the expected losses that were computed at the level of the bucket two with the reality in bucket three.
Just to clarify, the decision that has been taken so far by the board as it relates to buckets two and three is that's based on how you evaluated the asset for transfer, not necessarily how you're measuring the asset. We do intend on bringing back to the board the whole question about bucket two and three, and do you need to have two separate buckets for that, since they're both measured at lifetime losses. Currently today, there is an analysis. In IFRS 7, you are required to disclose an analysis of the assets that you measure individually or that you analyze individually. So we're not anticipating or proposing to the board that we would remove any of the disclosures from IFRS 7 that could still be applicable under this model, just to update them for this model and then add anything that we're told is needed or necessary. For example, specifically how you calculate expected losses is something that we've heard, the assumptions that you use, the hard numbers that you're using to get there.
Sarah, help me with something. Do we need to go to bucket two to go to bucket three, or sometimes you can go from bucket one to bucket three?
That's
so
right.
You don't need to transition from 2 to 3. You can go from 1 to 3. I just want to be very clear on that.
Presumably, you could go from 2 to 3 without there being any further write-down recognized. It's just that what you'd expected becomes atomized into
it. Usually it might be because you are doing specific. So I would think, personally, I would think there would be more when you're moving from 2 to 3 because you're looking at a specific loan rather than a portfolio.
But you
actually number speaking.
You may have a transfer from bucket 1 to bucket 2 because your probability of default goes from 5% to 40%. And then you have the loss given default, which is whatever it is, maybe 90%. And then when the customer is really bankrupt, then your probability of default is now 100%. And the loss given default is now maybe 100 or 90. Given the covenant you have. So you may have an increase in the provision just because you transfer from a 40% PD to 100% PD.
Yep.
Within bucket three.
That could happen within bucket three. You could have, when it went to from 5 to 40%, for example, you might have moved it directly into bucket three.
But too ugly, as we said.
So, this is sort of the area I wanted to probe around, and as I may have said several times, I'm not big on buckets. And I think that you've got two measurement methodologies. I would have preferred one, and I think we sort of have one now. It's not a fantastic one, and you don't have all the criteria that are specified, so you wouldn't be able to track the movements that I think you want to be able to see. But there is one. Now with two, I think it is going to be important. I think this area of the transferring and the measurement, I would expect that given equivalent circumstances, it wouldn't matter if it's in bucket two or bucket three. I should, because that's one measurement methodology, the numbers should be the same, right? I think as there are movements and more information discovered, then that's a change in circumstances and estimation. You know, things have moved on, there's a real change there. But I wouldn't expect it to matter whether it was in one or two or three, rather. And I would like to stop talking about one, two, and three as well. If there's anything you can do to sort of eliminate that sort of terminology when we finally get there, because I just think it is creating a sense that there are three measurement methods and there aren't. I think it may be important to know how the bank in particular is managing and whether it's on a specific portfolio basis, but maybe that's more through disclosure and the less sort of emphasis on that it could be measured differently depending where it is, I think the better, because that will mean if it's in either of these, if it's characterized as not being in the 12 months, it means the same thing, so that when I look at the numbers, they mean the same thing. If I want to take meaning from what's reported, it needs to have meaning in the first place.
Fair point, yeah.
But what do you think about the point that maybe in bucket two, those loans are still accruing interest, and in bucket three, they may no longer be accruing interest based on the regulatory decisions that
then.
Are non-accrual status.
I didn't think it was different. Is it different?
No. Accruing or not accruing interest? Well, maybe in terms of allowance is the same, but in terms of the recognition of interest on the portfolio.
Whether that's a different model to me, that's a different measurement. And that's different than I'd understood.
Did we make the decision?
No, not yet.
I think its interest is accrued all the time. Yeah. That's the difference between us and the past week.
Maybe it's more regulatory aspect than anything else, but when the loans get to a certain point in terms of deterioration of quality, you no longer accrue interest in your P&L. The interest is just neutralized. Whereas in bucket two, you continue to accrue interest. Right?
Well, that decision hasn't been made by the...
It hasn't been made, but maybe there is an information value in knowing whether a portion of the portfolio is still accruing interest and another one is not.
But haven't you just created a bucket four?
No.
Which is
no, because most loans in bucket three would not accrue interest.
Why not? It could be always easy to identify. You know, a big property project goes from, you know, what you expect over 12 months. Something happens, that goes straight to bucket three initially because, you know, the cash flow you're going to have to write down by 40%. And then, but within bucket three, you could then write it off, and 60%, 80%, oh, gone altogether. But it's because it's identifiable, isn't it? Rather than...
If you want to go down the path of a different interest recognition method for bucket three, the board might need to consider a different... distinction between bucket two and bucket three than the individual versus collective.
I'm not saying it changes the allowance measurement. The allowance is the allowance.
No, that's
but
that's
the
right.
Criteria of the portfolio may differ. Those loans which are in either or the other portfolio and may have different characteristics in terms of accrual status or non-accrual status, possibly. I'm not saying there should be on the distinction in the measurement of the allowance, but there is maybe some need to know which part of the portfolio is no longer accruing interest. That might not match bucket three criteria, I agree. It would be smaller than bucket three.
I got a good idea. Those of you who have questions for Philip, take him out for drinks and let him buy drinks for you guys. Then we can discuss on that. But Jed, you have a question.
Actually, I have two. One was, I thought bucket two and bucket three were often going to be determined by the systems that the bank uses. So, for example, some banks... we'll say, okay, when people have missed a payment, they go into, and you're saying bucket two and treat it as a portfolio, but some may well put it in bucket three and say, okay, what's his employment status? You know, where do they live? Lots of individual credit scoring that gets to a specific provision for that individual. It isn't, and they're actually going bucket three, even though the reality is it's a small risk-adjusted provision. That person isn't necessarily in a workout because we think they're definitely going to default and we're trying to calculate a precise number. But it still falls into a bucket three, I think, because it's individually assessed.
So I think the collection focus of the bank goes into more targeted. That's how I have rationalized the bucket three to be, that people start going individual loans to go and say, you know, Jed, we need to go after this guy, rather than a portfolio of people living in eastern part of London or something like that, just too much.
That's
more
quite often just a system sort of reason. But so the other thing, just looking through possible narrative and other disclosures, the things that sort of leap out at me are things like some more information about the collateralized nature of the loan, how much it's guaranteed, things like, rather than just commercial, you know, how much of it's property backed versus relying on cash flows or whatever. You've got a floating charge over inventory and working and debtor balances or what, some sort of more information would be useful rather than just those buckets.
And loss given default?
And loss, yeah.
I guess that ties into the level of securitization collateral.
Level of security that sits there. And presumably the line for sovereign, I assume you guys will have got
banks have got loans to sovereigns.
Unfortunately, these are not just for banks. These are for everybody. So think of those poor guys. Hiroishi?
Yeah. I hope that you develop a much simplified disclosure for non-financial companies, such as manufacturing companies. As you noticed in the case of Novartis, they disclose level 1, 2, 3 information of financial instruments that I think that in case of manufacturing, we do not need to disclose the information of bucket 1, 2, 3. You propose a simplified accounting treatment on page 8. So I hope you develop a simplified disclosure, which is similar to existing accounting standards.
Thank you. Sarah, should we jump, Sarah and Manion, should we jump to the preparer perspective? If you want to have any specific questions, ask there. I think one thing I would like to hear is the cost benefit for the non, because there are no financial institutions represented from the preparer side.
I just left.
That's what I'm there.
I got a small part.
Your part, right, Olivia? Yeah. No, Kevin is going to start about.
No, in every country in the world, it's illegal for us to sell gold on credit. So not a problem.
Good. So you guys don't have any cost consideration to worry?
Not allowed to sell gold on credit.
No, I think it's the same as Yamada-san has talked about. It's to keep it on a simplified basis. I think that itself resolves a lot of cost conflicts.
For the trade receivables.
Yeah. Good. Anything else you want to ask this group, Sarah and Manuel?
If any users have any specific examples of companies making good credit disclosures on their financial assets that they found really useful, if you could just send it to us. That would be quite helpful.
Presumably, HSBC's 400 pages is, unless they're completely wasting their time, somewhere just a long list of things that's useful.
I think we should, if we are doing that, we should have both financial institutions and non-financial institutions to send it across to. We should have the balance there. Anything else? It's been a long day, but it's been a fruitful day, at least in my mind. So I'd like to hear any other thoughts, anything else. Otherwise, we will close the public session. And thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Manuel.
Thank you.